Eisenbaum from Muhlenberg College, and you are a biologist there, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm a plant ecologist, and I also teach sustainability studies here at Muhlenberg.
And your students, they are doing studies under your guidance, and they do things with learning about how plant medicines work?
We've had some students who focus on plant medicines, but the bulk of our work, which relates to plant medicines, is how plant chemistry, which are the medicinal properties of plants, varies in relation to environment and how that in turn affects the insects that eat them. So more specifically about plant chemistry, both the kinds you smell and the kinds you might taste, not so much on the exact medical benefits of those chemicals.
Well, before we got together with you, sometimes we do a little background research on the people that we're going to be interviewing, and we did a background check on you.
Yeah, how'd that turn out?
It turned out pretty good. We found out that your name means sneezing tree. Could you tell us about the tree of your heritage?
Well, that's very funny. So Niesenbaum, my family actually came from Russia, but the German word Niesen means sneeze, and Baum, like Tannenbaum, means tree. But another translation that I heard, which I prefer, is the word Genießen with a G in front of it means joy. And then I would be Tree of Joy. That's a little bit more romantic than Sneeze Tree. And we were actually just talking about this because when people emigrated to this country, their names got changed, and so we're not exactly sure. But my son, who's 9 years old, he is being a Nussbaum for Halloween. And do you know what Nussbaum means?
No.
Nut tree.
Oh.
So he's going to, he thought it would be easier to be a nut tree than a sneeze tree. So we've been painting a cardboard trunk and making a tree with nuts on it, and he's going to be Nussbaum.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
But we don't know much about the sneeze tree origin or how that relates, because that goes way back, because my family came from the Ukraine in the early 1900s, and, you know, obviously there's German origin before then, so it's hard to trace back the exact origin of that name.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, I hear that spice bush is your specialty, and what got you interested in spice bush? How did you first come across it?
That's a great question. Spice bush, Lindera benzoin. Working in Pennsylvania, I was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania, and the first thing you do when you're in graduate school is you got to find a project, something to work on, and my advisor said, go spend time in the forest, which is, you know, how many people get to do that for a living? And I said, sure, I'll go spend time and come up with a list of questions.
Sure.
And, the one thing that I noticed is that spice bush was everywhere. And, it flowers before its leaves comes out. And I was very interested in plant-insect interactions. And so I started looking at pollination. The flowers come out in April, when pollinators are quite rare. It's also dioecious, which means it's separate sex. There are separate male and female plants. Most plants are hermaphroditic, where the flowers have both male and female anatomy. And so I was very interested in that as well. And so I started looking at whether pollen was limiting the reproductive success. That is, since pollinators are so rare in April, it was often snowing when I would do my field work, certainly cold. Is pollen limiting fruit production and reproductive success, or our resources? That's sort of where I got started. And then I got interested in differential allocation to male and female anatomy and function with environment.
Is cannabis another one of those plants that's dioecious?
It is.
Okay.
As is holly, and other kinds of plants are called monoecious, like corn, where you still have separate male and female flowers, but they're on the same plant. Dioecious is separate male and female plants. Only about 3% of plants are dioecious. It's relatively rare. People are interested in how that might have evolved. One obvious reason is to reduce the opportunity of mating with self, which can have genetic ramifications.
And who are the pollinators in April?
Yeah, so nothing that impressive. You know, they're like scrappy little solitary bees and insects, very small insects, and you know, nothing like a big bumblebee or bird or anything like that.
Now, when you say a solitary bee, do you mean a solitary honeybee?
A bee that is not like in a colony, you know, just operating on its own. Flies or other things that pollinate these plants, and nothing like any kind of organized pollination system that you might see later in the season where bees are foraging and communicating to each other and things like that.
But, I mean, when you say a solitary, could it be a rogue honeybee or a solitary honeybee?
No, I think that it refers more to the species itself, yeah.
The way I first came across spicebush was I was in the woods looking for witch hazel in April.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard on the radio that it blooms in April,
mm-hmm.
but then later I heard that it blooms at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So I confronted someone who was a plant person about this, and he said that the cultivated witch hazel blooms in the beginning of the year, and the wild witch hazel blooms at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, in the natural system, we get witch hazel flowering before. It's all relative, but, you know, a month before or during the winter, actually. It's one of the few flowers you might see during the winter, that and skunk cabbage.
Mm-hmm. So, let me ask you the Latin name. What is the meaning of Lindera?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I did at one time. Lindera benzoin. Do you know the answer to that question?
No, Mike. I was just going to ask you if it had anything to do with the linden, if it was related.
No, it doesn't. No. And benzoin, you know, there's benzoic acid. It may have something to do with the chemistry, but I looked that up years ago, and you know, nobody's asked me that since. But I can tell you a little bit about the family. It's in the laurel family or Lauraceae. And the great thing about this family, it's a really important family. It's pretty rare in the temperate zone. There's not that many members of the family here. But in the tropics, it's a really important family. It's the avocado family.
Oh.
And if you look at the spicebush fruit, there may still be a few fruits out there. They're dispersed by migratory birds in the fall. They're little red fruits, kind of shiny, very aromatic. They're high in fat content, like avocados. They have a single large seed in them, like avocados.
Huh.
And birds come and strip the fruit off the seed. Migratory birds are looking for calories, especially this time of year. They're high in fat content, and then they basically spit that seed out from their gizzard. They don't pass it through. It's kind of big.
Hmm.
Interestingly, you may have heard of the resplendent quetzal, which is the national bird of Guatemala, and common in Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And in fact, I take students to Costa Rica every year, and we try to see the quetzal. And they live off of relatives of Lindera, of spicebush. They live off, the genus for avocado is Persea, but they live off wild species. They're not like the big avocados that you might have in guacamole.
Mm-hmm.
But they, again, it's a green fruit, high in fat content, with a large seed that they spit out. And so it's an important tropical family, and spicebush is the dominant member of the family up here in eastern North America.
Now, is pawpaw also related? Pawpaw seems very much like an avocado.
It's related chemically, actually. Like, the insects that eat our plant also commonly eat pawpaw, but I don't think it's in the same family.
Interesting. And is the spicebush related to the bay leaf?
Not in the same family, no.
Okay, I think I saw something about laurel bay, but I guess...
Yeah, like...
That's not...
Yeah, there is, like, the common name laurel is different. So I'm looking up pawpaw to see what family that is, but anyway... Yeah, that's in the Ananaceae, a different family. But it's interesting because these plants can be unrelated from different families and converge on very similar traits, including chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned medicinal plants. I've been interested in sort of using medicinal information to tell us about how plants might be related, either ecologically or evolutionarily. If plants have the same chemical activity medicinally, that tells you something about their relatedness.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So sort of working backwards. You can work both ways.
Right.
If you have one plant that has a certain activity and you're looking for another possibility, you look at plants that are related to it, either growing in similar conditions or in the same family. Or you could take existing medicinal knowledge and look at that to examine relatedness.
So how edible are the berries for human consumption?
I encourage people to head out to the woods. Spend some time in the woods, as my advisor told me, and see if you can find one of those red berries, and it's called spice bush because of the aromatic vegetation, but the berry itself is really aromatic. Some people call it citrus berry, some people call it wild allspice. It is listed as an edible fruit, but it's dried and ground and used more as a spice than as something you would eat. I think it's got a mouthful of chemistry that is not going to be that pleasant to consume, but as a spice, it's interesting, most things that are spicy, these are plant defensive compounds, and a little bit is good, but too much makes you sick, you know, and so because they're not there to please our palate, they're there to defend the plant against things eating it.
Uh-huh. So you said flowers in April, when do the berries mature?
Yeah, so it's quite incredible that it has such a long season, and I've done some thinking about this. If flowers in April and the fruits ripen in September and October for these migratory birds.
Wow.
And a lot of people will argue that, you know, when a plant flowers depends on when the pollinators are available. And so the evolution of flowering time or phenology depends on pollinator availability. And they're always thinking selection on the flower is the pollinator, selection on the flower is the pollinator, selection on the fruit is the fruit disperser. But we know that these fruits are dispersed by migratory birds, which are only around in September and October, and their fruits are very expensive to make, high in fat content, and it's a shade plant, so it takes a long time to mature those fruits. So it may be that the reason why this plant flowers so early is because that's how long it takes to make an expensive fruit available in September. So I've done some thinking and research on that as well.
So between April and September, can you see the berries beginning to form?
Yeah, you can. So like in late April, you can see the ovary portion of the flower, which is what becomes a fruit. In fact, we define a fruit as a ripened ovary. We can see that ovary starting to swell. The petals drop off, and you have a little green fruit. And then those slowly mature over time, getting larger and larger and larger. And during that time, you might have a cluster of fruits, and some of those fruits abort. So not all of them make it. A lot of my research looked at that pattern of abortion of fruits and whether it's a random process or depends on who or how many pollinators came to that flower. And it turns out that the females are investing their resources in the fruits that had the best pollination event and allow some sort of a competition among its offspring to occur so that resources are being invested in the best quality seed.
So that accounts for the abortion of the different
fruits. Yeah, so they're making more fruit. Initially, they're making more fruits than they have the resources to mature.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of a, I hate to use the word decision-making process because, it's, you know, they're plants.
Have a central ganglion?
Exactly. They're not deciding. But my work early on showed that it's not a random process. They're not just like some are making it and some. And the way I did this is I followed the pollination event in April. I marked the flowers and I followed individual ovaries from May all the way through September and map them and watch which ones dropped off. And then I also knew how many pollen grains landed on their stigma, how many pollinators went to those, and showed that plants are preferentially maturing fruits that receive more pollen.
Very, very interesting. Is there any animal or insect that would eat the fruits before they're mature?
I think I haven't seen any evidence of that or any evidence of fungal attack, and the green fruits are really loaded with chemistry to defend themselves. That's part of the expense. And you can tell that by smelling it or cutting it open and just putting it on your tongue, and you'll get a very bitter reaction. So there's nothing that comes to eat them early. They're pretty camouflaged, too. But when they turn red, they're really obvious in the green understory, and birds come in. I have done some study which shows that when they are ripe, rodents like squirrels and chipmunks will take the fruits, but they do the opposite. They spit the fruit out and eat the seed.
Huh, that's interesting.
Which is not in the plant's best interest.
And do you know if the seed is edible for human consumption?
I haven't seen anything along those lines.
Okay.
Yeah.
If there is a plant that has a... Do both the male and female get flowers?
Yeah, so the males have sort of... if you go out in the winter, you can actually tell the difference between a male and a female. Well, maybe only I can. I've been doing this a while. But one could learn how to tell the difference in that the males produce bigger, showier flowers, relatively speaking, because they have the anthers with the pollen. And you can actually see the floral buds are being laid down now, and you can see the floral buds that are bigger will be the male flowers. They're males, and the smaller buds are females. Interestingly, the male flowers open before the female flowers. And there's selection to do that. You want to be, if you're a male, you want to get your sperm, your pollen out first, right? So you want to be the first one open so that when the first female opens, your pollen's reaching that female.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
It's a race.
Yep, it's a race. And so you might see males open 3, 4, 5 days first, and then the females open, and the flowers last about 1 to 3 weeks.
Wow!
And then the male flowers drop off, and they won't have any evidence of flower, and obviously no fruit during the summer.
But does the male produce fruit at any time or no?
The males don't produce fruit.
Okay,
it's not a perfect system. There are occasionally. You know, something changes, and you might find a female flower rarely occurring on a male plant, and it may make a fruit, but that's a very rare event.
So is the spice bush something that's native to our area?
It is.
Okay.
It's a great native plant. People are interested in doing, who are interested in doing landscaping with native plants. It's great for a couple of reasons, and certainly my yard is loaded with spice bush.
Oh, wow.
One, it's the most beautiful plant, and well, that's my opinion. But also, deer don't eat it, and most of us, or rarely eat it, I should say. And most of us are plagued by deer destroying our landscape. And that's probably why it is so common and so obviously common in the understory, at least in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure in your area, deer are devouring the understory. But the spice bush is thriving, and that's because the deer don't touch it. I've seen deer browse the twigs in winter, but they probably are not doing too much damage to them because of the chemistry.
Is it becoming more popular as an ornamental?
I think, like, if you go to native plant sales, like, we have a place called the Wildlands Conservancy here in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania that has a native plant sale. It's frequently one of the more common plants that's being sold. So it's great. You know, it thrives in wetter soils, but I've planted it, in my flower beds.
What conditions do you need to grow it? Does it have to be an understory? Could it be in the middle of your yard?
I've never planted it in the middle of my yard. I've seen it grow in open field. It's interesting plant because it's a shade plant, but it thrives in sunlight. In fact, grows more and reproduces more in the sunlight. And I think it's because it's got this sort of sit and wait. These plants live, hundreds of years, and I think they have a sort of sit and wait reproductive biology where they're waiting for a gap to open up and then they grow. A gap is when a tree falls and sun is now shining down on the shade habitat. They grow, they crank out the number of flowers, and they have a burst of fruit production. And so I haven't ever planted them in the middle of my yard, but I have them along the side of my house and along the wood's edge, and they do great in shade,
uh-huh,
partial sun, And if you put them in full sun, they just have to be wet. You know, it has to be a wet site.
Oh, I see. So that's why they are considered to be a shade plant, is because usually there's more moisture in the...
They're considered to be a shade plant because when Pennsylvania was all forest, it thrived in the shade. Now Pennsylvania is a map of postage stamp fragments, and so there are plants on the edges that are getting a lot more sun, and they actually do well.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a plant that evolved in and is native to shadier habitats.
And so it also likes swampy areas?
Yeah, wet lowland areas. It tends not to grow upland.
When I found it growing, it was next to skunk cabbage.
Yeah, well, that's about as wet as it gets, I guess. Yeah.
Do you have any other tips for planting if people want to plant this in there on their property?
We've started them in... starting them from seed's a bit of a challenge. You have to go through a regimen of chilling and warming and germinating, and it takes a long time. But what you can do is buy them from a native plant sale. Usually people are harvesting small plants from the woods, and I don't encourage people to go to like a natural site and do that. But if you can get whole plant and just plop them in the ground, keep them watered, and they do great.
And does it grow in other parts of the world?
It grows to about Georgia up to Ontario, east of the Mississippi. It's an East Coast plant. Now, there are other Linderas that are Asian, so on the Asian continent. I don't have much experience with them, but some people have worked out some of the chemistry on those, so I just know the literature from that. But this particular species is just an Eastern North American species.
Let me just take this opportunity to tell listeners you're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you'd like to reach us here at the radio station, you can give us a call. The telephone number is 859-4200. That's 859-4200. Do you know anything about the medicinal use of spicebush?
I know people make, and I've had students fool around with this, they make a tea from the leaves or from the twigs, and that's supposed to be like a general, tonic for health. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of any sort of published work on that beyond that.
In Peterson's field guide, it just has mentioned that of 54 plants tested, spicebush is the best as an anti-candida.
Uh-huh.
So...
That's interesting.
And do you know anything about historical uses of spicebush, medicinal or otherwise?
I think just as a tea.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also the fruit, as I mentioned, grinding up the dried fruit as a spice. So.
And also, are there any plants, insects, fungi that are non-native that are threatening the survival of spicebush in the ecosystem?
The insects that currently eat spicebush, which I study because I've now moved from pollination to looking at the caterpillars that eat them, are native insects, and they are being controlled naturally, both by the chemistry of the plant, but also by attacking insects that we believe use the plant chemistry as a cue. So an insect, a caterpillar, the most common is the tulip tree beauty is the common name of it, is a little sort of inchworm caterpillar, is eating the leaf of spicebush, and it's a specialist, so it can deal with its chemistry pretty well and can thrive on spicebush and only spicebush. But when it eats the leaves are emitting a volatile compound or a smelly compound or a spicy compound. Just like when, if you go out into the woods today, like I've asked all of you to do, if you go out there and rip the leaf, you will smell it yourself. And attacking insects use that as a cue. So there are wasps and flies that then come and lay their eggs in the caterpillar, and then the eggs hatch and consume the caterpillar from the inside out. It's quite gruesome.
Wow.
And defend that. And so, somewhat amazingly, a plant, we know the plant can't run away, the plant can't shake the enemy off it, but it can signal the enemy of its enemy, which I find really fascinating. So we've been spending a lot of time sampling the scent of these plants, and we have some sophisticated equipment to do that. And we've shown not only do these insects stimulate the release, but you could take a plant and just cut it with scissors or tear it, and you get one chemical bouquet released. But when that specific insect eats the plant, you get a different chemical bouquet. And so the question is whether that is specifically cueing the enemies of the caterpillar to the plant. And that's exactly where we are in our studies now, trying to figure that out.
And so could it be the saliva or whatever is part of the biochemistry of the caterpillar? Is the plant is sensing that and then reacting to it?
Exactly.
Because that sounds similar to, I read Stephen Buhner's book about Lyme disease.
Uh-huh.
And it's very much of these interactions of chemistry back and forth between the host and the parasite.
That's our hypothesis, because if mechanical, I mean, we try to mimic the mechanical damage of the caterpillar, and we get a different response than when the caterpillar does the damage. And in fact, we've done experiments where we take caterpillars that don't that are generalists, that haven't really evolved or co-evolved with spicebush, and they cause a different chemical bouquet to be released. So that suggests that it is the specificity of the saliva or some biochemical process.
And how do you measure or quantify the chemical bouquet?
We have two ways to do it. One, we have a basically you have to do is capture the scent and then measure the scent. And you measure the scent using gas chromatography, which separates out compounds based on mass, and then mass spectrometry, which allows you to identify those compounds. So it's a separation process and then an identification process. And we have two machines that do this. One, we have these things called SPEMI fibers, which are little fibers that are in a needle. We put a bag around the leaf. We actually use Ovens Reynolds bag because they have no volatile release.
Oh.
Because if you put it around your chicken to cook it, you wouldn't want it to smell like a plastic bag, right? So,
right. So
we put those around the leaves, and then we can actually insert this needle. We put a caterpillar on there, we allow it to equilibrate for a certain amount of time, and then we inject this needle into the bag, and then we expose the fiber. And the fiber is absorbent and will absorb any volatile compounds that are in that headspace or airspace. And then we leave that in there for a certain amount of time. Then we withdraw that fiber back up into the needle, bring it back to the lab, and then we insert it into our gas spectrophotometer, which basically heats that fiber up, releasing the chemicals and separating them and then quantifying and identifying them. The other toy we have is really neat. It's called a Z-nose, which is an electronic nose. We actually can bring it to the field and do the same thing. It's not as good as identifying the compounds, but once we've identified them using the first method, we can use this as a quick, we can get a reading of what the plant is emitting in less than 2 minutes. So
wow.
We can do a lot. And so these electronic noses, or field noses, as we call them, are really wonderful tools.
What does equilibrate mean?
Equilibrate means, like, so you have a bag, right, and it's got, it's, you first put it around the leaf, and the leaf is releasing those compounds, those volatile compounds, into the bag space, and at some point, that bag space is going to become at equilibrium or at least filled with those scents rather than the open air that was originally in the bag. So we're basically waiting for the bag to fill up with those volatile compounds.
In the fiber that you talk about that's collecting these compounds, do you know what material that's made of?
They're called SPEMI fibers. I'm not exactly sure what the specific material is.
Just curious.
SPME.
Okay.
SPEMI, yeah.
And I just wanted to mention, going back to the Latin name, someone said perhaps the second part of the name refers to a benzene ring, because things that have a strong scent, like cinnamon or other plants like that, have benzene rings that are associated with the strong smells?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mentioned earlier. I thought the benzoin related to something chemical. Because you can buy, like, benzoic acid or benzoin, you know, as a compound.
And then what about something in food additives like sodium benzoate?
Whether they're two are related, I don't know.
Okay.
But, yeah. I mean, the kinds of compounds that we study in the plant, we study those volatile ones that you smell, and they're things like limonene, smells like lime, caryophyllene, osamine. These are the... By volatile, we mean ones that sort of move through air and have a scent. We also study compounds that are sort of stationary in the leaf, and these are called phenolics, and these are the really sort of bitter tastes that might react, your tongue might react to. And so they're loaded with those kinds of compounds as well.
So,
but we haven't seen anything with the name benzoin in it.
Is it maybe possible that historically it could be used as a preservative?
I've never seen any evidence of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When your students are making a tea out of it, what parts of the plants are they using?
Twigs and leaves.
Okay, so the leaves are used as well.
Yeah.
Is there anything in your else from your research that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched on?
Well, let me think. We were interested. Remember, we that it's dioecious, and we thought. One hypothesis we had would be that male plants get eaten by insects less than female plants, or more. You know, differential, what we call sex-biased herbivory. And so one hypothesis might be that females get eaten more because they're allocating more resources to make those expensive fruits, and so they don't have as much defense.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could argue... This is what's great about science is you know that you can have a variety of hypotheses and really the proof is in the test of that hypothesis. One could also hypothesize that, well, it's really important to make those fruits, so females are going to invest more in their leaves, so they have those leaves to photosynthesize to allocate resources to those fruits. And so we spent a lot of time looking at whether there was sex-biased herbivory, and there isn't. So there's no differences in defensive compounds or the amount that's being eaten with the sex of the plant. But there are huge differences from plant to plant independent of sex, and we believe that's being driven by environment, mostly light conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how does the amount of light that they receive affect the plant? What are the differences?
Oh, huge. So, like, you can actually, we've done transplant experiments where we take plants from the sun in the shade and move them around and look at how they change chemically over time. And the plants in the sun make thicker, tougher leaves that are higher. We have a paper coming out in the Canadian Journal of Botany in a few months, which shows that plants in the sun have more total phenolics. If we look at all the phenolic compounds, they're greater in the sun, and that certain phenolic compounds are higher in the sun, but not all. So light is really influencing the defensive chemistry, and the thing that's sort of driven the study is, interestingly, that plants in the sun get eaten much less than the plants in the shade.
Hmm. I've heard that different plants under stress produce more phytochemicals?
It is. So, like, the some people, you could argue that it's a resource thing. In the sun, there's more light for photosynthesis, so they can make more defensive compounds. But those defensive compounds, phenolics, they play more than one role. They defend the plant from herbivores, but they also protect the plant from stress related to light. And so what is the actual causal factor, we're not exactly sure, but we know we're one of the earlier studies, certainly the first study in this system, to show this differential phenolic production with light.
Is there any speculation on... I lost the question. Let me skip to the next one. Is anyone surprising contacted you about your research, to use your research?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in the research, and we present every year at the Ecological Society of America conference, and we get a lot of great feedback. There's, you know, this is a hot area of research, this area of what we call tritrophic interactions. We have three feeding levels, right? We have the plant that's photosynthesizing. We have the herbivore or caterpillar that's eating the plant, and then we have the insects that are attacking the herbivore, the caterpillar, right? So these wasps and flies. And so there's three trophic levels or three feeding levels. And we know that that's being driven. Each level is a chemical interaction. The insect eating the plant is getting a mouthful of phenolics and other compounds. And that the third trophic level, the parasitoid wasps and flies, are cueing on that chemistry. A lot of people are doing work on this, but primarily in agricultural species like tomato and tobacco and things like that. Obviously, we're interested in this as we move in the direction of more natural or organic farming, because this is taking advantage of a plant's natural anti-herbivore defense system. And so we're studying it in a natural system because I'm really committed and dedicated to understanding, you know, natural forest systems. But it has applications for agriculture. One example is if these a good friend of mine is an organic farmer, and what we've talked about is he's trying to attract beneficial insects to his field. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about taking these aromatic plants that we know attract these insects, and maybe sort of making a mulch out of them and putting them along the beds of those of his crops that might then attract increased third feeding level insects to attack the caterpillars that are on his plant. We haven't published any of this. This is just an idea that we're fooling around with, but I think the great thing about ecology is you sort of study a natural system, and then you start to think about, well, we're farming with natural systems. How can we sort of take advantage of that rather than spraying with, you know, human-made chemicals?
Right.
Yeah.
And how fast can the plant react or change its chemistry to defend against new predators? Have you studied that at all?
We studied, it's called induction, or and so there are compounds that a plant can make, and then make it all the time. And then there are compounds that a plant can make in response to being eaten, and particularly expensive compounds. A plant doesn't want to be making those expensive in terms of energy unless it needs them. And so a lot of work in a variety of systems, but we've demonstrated in our system, shows that the presence of an insect changes the chemistry of the leaf within a few hours, even to days. So it's a very quick response.
And are there other applications besides agricultural?
I like to think about the agricultural applications, but we're also thinking about, you know, the fate of our native ecosystems as they become fragmented, trying to understand their reproductive biology, as the environment changes as well. So we know that light and temperature also influence rate patterns of herbivory, and we know that as the climate is changing, we expect to see that impacting native systems, and I think we know very little about what that impact will be. And so one of our studies, our proposed studies, is to start to look at the interactions, the chemically driven interactions between spicebush and its insects, along the latitudinal gradient, working towards in the south, comparing it up to the north. Maybe we'll start a study site up by you if you have some spice bush, and looking at how these vary, because we know these conditions are going to shift northward over time, and I think we know very little bit about how that's going to influence a complex interaction, a three feeding level interaction like the one we study here in Pennsylvania.
Right, and there's probably even more levels that we're just not aware of yet.
There are more levels. We've had, so we take our caterpillars, we put them in a, we collect them, we put them in a baggie, we feed them spice bush leaves. a fly or wasp will hatch out of that fly, and then some out of the caterpillar, and then something else hatches out of that fly. So there's that. We've actually already seen four levels.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So basically, you're trying to learn the language of plants through phytochemicals. Perhaps.
Exactly. It's this. We call it chemical ecology. It's about chemical interactions because that is how they communicate. There's some evidence that shows that they call it the talking trees hypothesis. We haven't seen this in spicebush, but it doesn't mean it doesn't occur. Where a plant that's getting, we just talked about induction, where a plant that's getting eaten changes its chemistry. But not only that, it's been shown that a plant growing next to a plant that's been eaten changes its chemistry because it can perceive the release of those volatile compounds. And so there may be interplant communication, if you will, that's occurring by way of volatile compounds.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Have you done any research or know anything about plants or communication in the forest with spicebush and its neighbors through mycelial networks?
We have looked at mycorrhizal associations in spicebush because we know that they are, you know, fundamentally important ecologically in most systems. And so we were interested in how that might vary, and that in turn might influence its chemistry. And so I think a new hot area of research is looking at how below-ground interactions, plant fungi below ground, influences above-ground interactions, plant-insect interactions. And so we're just in the exploratory phase, but there's been some people at Penn State and other research universities that are starting to look at this relationship. One of my former students, who is now a graduate student at Penn State in entomology, is looking at how nitrogen fixation below ground interactions influence herbivory and plant chemistry above ground.
What do you see as the ecological function of spicebush? Do you have a theory of it?
That's a good question. I think it's an important plant. It's fundamentally it's providing resources for migratory birds. So if you care about migratory birds, obviously you care about spicebush. But, you know, it's involved in multiple, as we already talked about. We also know birds eat the caterpillars, too. It's part of a complex ecosystem that we're just, you know, barely wrapping our heads around right now. And so I think the mistake, the big mistake about the conservation movement, it's often talking about an endangered species, or and it's usually one, you know, that's pretty or furry. But it's not about endangered species. It's about endangered interactions, complex interactions, and preserving those, because that's what ecosystems are all about. And so I think we're contributing to that knowledge base and trying to encourage the public that it's not about this sort of macro extinction, the loss of the species. Of course, that's a horrible thing, but there's sort of more of an insidious level of extinction that's going on that we might not even know, which is the death of an interaction. And what the implications are of that, we can imagine, but we don't really know a lot about.
Yeah, tell listeners again, you're listening to 88.7 WHCL FM, Clinton, New York. The time is 9:51. Our guest is Dr. Niesenbaum from Muhlenberg College, biologist, and we're talking about spicebush. If you have any questions, you're welcome to call in here. The number is 315-859-4200. That's 859-4200. Now, with this next question, I'm going to leave the plant biology and ask you, what do you see as the ecological function of the human species on the planet?
Well, I think, you know, for me, because I do a lot of a side area of work is I work a lot in Costa Rica and in the tropics, and I think, in addition, one of the scary parts about we often, when we talk about conservation, again, we're talking about species or habitat loss. But the thing is, you know, we're part of the ecosystem as well. And those tropical ecosystems and even temperate ecosystems, we're an intricate part of that. And I think until we recognize that we derive benefit, but we also can positively and negatively influence those ecosystems, we're doomed. And so any plan for conservation or preservation, in my opinion, has to recognize that interaction and make it work for the mutual benefit of both our species, humans, and the ecosystem. And so this is probably the difference between preservation and conservation or sustainability. Sustainability there's a lot of definitions out there for sustainability, but what I teach my students is it's basically a three-pronged approach, which is when we talk about sustainability of a community or an ecosystem, we're talking about obviously environmental protection, but we're also talking about economic sustainability, opportunities for economic development for the humans that live in that ecosystem, and then we're also talking about justice, human justice. And so it's combining an environmental ethos, an environmental ethic, and linking it to the well-being of humans, both from a social and environmental and public health perspective. And so a lot of my work has been to, rather than go into communities and say, stop utilizing this habitat, saying how can we utilize this habitat in a way that protects the environment and helps people, and I think that's the only way that's going to work in the long haul.
So when you're in the field studying spicebush, do you ever chew the branches of it while you're doing your work?
My students, that's funny that you say that. My students say that when they're working, they get overwhelmingly tired. And so they argue that it's the chemistry of the plant that's sort of having a sedative effect on them. But I argue that maybe they stayed out a little bit late the night before. I don't know. But
yeah.
But that's something that I hear year after year, which is that they believe that the compounds are making them sleepy. I've chewed on the spice bush, but yeah, it's bitter. It doesn't appeal to me. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah,
we had our dose this morning. I've made a tincture of the inner bark of it.
Yeah, what did it do for you?
I like it.
It's very tasty. Yeah, in what way? How does it taste to you?
I feel like it tastes.
I say spicy and fragrant.
Yeah.
I think that it tastes a little bit like calamus to me.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a little fruity, maybe a little bit like cinnamon, but it's very unique, and I really savor it.
I consumed a savory plant extract this morning from the species Coffea arabica and the Rubiaceae. one of my favorite plants, and so
we also consume that one as well.
Okay, good.
But we didn't have any of our other favorite, and I couldn't tell you the Latin name, but cacao.
Yeah,
and I was
Theobroma cacao chocolate.
Yes,
Theobroma translates from Latin. That one I can tell you, food of the gods.
Oh,
yeah,
I believe it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting with the we were reading Yul Gibbons' book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, or the mm-hmm. Helpful Herb, I forget which, and he was talking about the linden tree and mm-hmm. saying that you could make something that tastes like chocolate. And then as I was trying to find out more about it, nobody seems to have successfully created a chocolatey. I mean, nobody in recent times. So he, quote, cites people from the 1500s that made a chocolate-like thing out of it. You're combining the flower and the fruit of the linden, and they flower at the same time. The flower and the fruit are both on the mm-hmm. plant at the same time, which is coincidentally the same way that the cacao is. It has uh-huh. the flower and fruit at the same time. So I just thought it was interesting that they paralleled in their biology.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about? We have 3 minutes left.
I think we covered it pretty well. I encourage people who are interested, any listeners out there, to Google my name, Niesenbaum at Muhlenberg, and look at our website talking about our research, and feel free to drop me an email if you have any questions. My email's on that website, and Certainly, if you have spice bush in your area, go out and admire it and smell it and perhaps make a tea from it. And I hope your listeners have a greater appreciation for its life cycle when it flowers in April and is producing fruit in October. But other than that, I think we're good.
I have one last question for you. Yeah. Is there any connection between witch hazel that has a yellow flower and flowers in the winter?
The only connection is that these sort of early flowering plants that are in the understory tend to have the similar characteristic of greenish-yellow flowers, non-showy flowers, because they're not relying on these on those kinds of pollinators that respond to big showy flowers. But that's it's more of a convergence on a similar trait because they're living in similar conditions.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
And maybe we'll speak again.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.